George Hoffman from the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, members, George Hoffman from the Department of Human Services. And
Madam Chair, members, I'm Jane Rankin, also with the Department of Human Services.
If you could speak up a little bit, it's hard to hear you. Proceed.
I'm going to refer to two documents, well, maybe three. The thicker one is the package labeled Department of Human Services February 09 forecast, and that's our description of the forecast changes which we normally make public. I'm not going to go through that. That contains a lot of details about the forecast changes. I may point to one or two pages in there. There is also a single sheet which is headed February 2009 forecast changes in a nutshell.
I love it.
I'm going to go through the nutshell version.
Good.
And then you'll have an opportunity to ask questions, because the part of what a major part of what's happening in the forecast is the impact of the economic stimulus legislation. So I'm going to talk about that part of the economic stimulus, and then other people later are going to talk about the other parts of it.
Right. And Mr. Hoffman, I think one of the other things that we're interested in is kind of getting a snapshot of how much of the $2 billion increase in the deficit is due to any increase in human services spending.
Yes, and that's easily, you can see, I will point that out. You can easily see that in the one-page version of the forecast changes. Now, what changed in the economic stimulus legislation that has a huge impact on the forecast was a temporary increase in the federal medical assistance percentage, which I will refer to as the FMAP. We like acronyms in the Department of Human Services, so. The federal medical assistance percentage is a matching rate which is different state by state, and the method of calculating it is in federal statute. It changes annually. It's based on the personal per capita income of the state compared to personal per capita income of the nation. What it does is it gives a higher federal matching rate to the states that have a lower personal per capita income. But there is a floor rate of 50%. No state gets less than 50%. And for several years, Minnesota has been at the 50% rate. So the increase that we get in the federal medical assistance percentage is an increase from the floor rate of 50%. And there is another single page headed American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 that has a detailed description of how this increase in the federal medical assistance percentage works. And in short, I won't go through the whole thing, all of the states get a higher matching rate for a period of 9 calendar quarters from October of 2008 through the end of December 2010. And all the states get an increase of 6.2 percentage points in their matching rate. So that increases our rate to 56.2%. Then there is an additional factor added onto the rate according to how much increase each state has had in its unemployment rate, and that adds some additional points. And there, so our rate is going to change for the first three quarters of the enhanced rate. We are expecting to get a federal medical assistance percentage of 60.19%, and then as our unemployment rate goes up, as it's expected to do, we'll get the highest add-on available, and our federal matching rate will go up to 61.59%. To date, CMS has confirmed the rate of 60.19% for the first two quarters. So that rate has been confirmed, and the only question left is when is the movement to the higher rate going to occur? I believe we are assured that it will happen by July. The only thing that seems to me to be in question is there is a small possibility that it will go up one quarter early.
And is the unemployment rate measured quarterly then, or is it a set point in time? Or?
Well, the federal law says that it's based on monthly data. From the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it's based on the most recent 3 months of data at the time that the quarterly rate is set, and so that's part of the uncertainty. We don't know for the next quarter exactly what 3 months of data the feds are going to use, but it's based on a three-month average, the most recent 3 months of data available, and it's compared to the lowest three-month average that the state has experienced since January 06.
So, for instance, the last quarter in December, in 2010, we don't know what our unemployment rate will be by then. And so is it possible that the 61.59% would be going down by then?
The federal law provides that once it goes up, it stays up.
Oh, well, that's handy.
So we know once it goes up, it isn't going to come down.
You know, I'm still getting used to getting a break from the feds once in a while. So. Any other questions on this? Okay, let's go on then.
Okay, so if you look now at the one-page forecast summary, what I've displayed on there is the change in forecast, and I start with the general fund total. So it's all the general fund forecasted programs. And in the current biennium, we have a decrease of $522 million. And if you look down to the next line, you see that the FMAP change accounts for a decrease of $464 million out of the $522. So most of the movement in the forecast in the current biennium comes from the FMAP change. And the difference, which is not accounted for by the FMAP change, is the next line, and that's a decrease of $58.7 million. And it's the same approach in the next biennium, We have a forecast decrease of $1.2 billion, and we have an FMAP change, that is our gain from the FMAP change in medical assistance, is a decrease of $1.4 billion. And so net of the FMAP change, the forecast movement in the next biennium is an increase of $144 million. So that's, I think, the answer to your question of what's happening to the forecast apart from the FMAP change.
So of the $2 billion, with a B, increase, Health and Human Services is only 144,000 of it, or million of it.
144 million. That's correct, Madam Chair, apart from the FMAP change.
I just think it's important for people to remember that, because there are some parts of the Capitol that keep talking about this tremendous growth in Health and Human Services budget.
It's not much of a change in the forecast by our normal standards.
I agree.
Now, the explanation of the change in the current biennium, as usual, most of the change is in medical assistance. So 55.7 out of the 58.7 is a medical assistance change. And of the 55.7, 50 million of decrease is from the governor's unallotments. And so that's the basic story of the current biennium forecast change. A whole lot of it comes from the governor's unallotments. Now, if we look at the next biennium, we have a 77 million increase in medical assistance. And about almost two-thirds of that comes from Merck federal funding adjustments. Now, the Merck that I'm talking about is a medical education payment which is based on MA capitation rates, MA managed care rates, and money is cut out of those rates and paid to the health department, and then the health department subsequently disperses the money to the institutions that get the medical education payments. And the arrangement which has developed because of timing issues is that the Department of Health gets the money in fiscal year A, and they disperse the money in fiscal year B. And that means, under federal rules, we can't claim the federal match on that money until fiscal year B. Now, part of what's going on here in this Merck adjustment is the governor unallotted $38 million of Merck payments in fiscal year 9. Now, that's the full amount we would have That's a full amount we would have paid to the Department of Health. But if we had paid that amount to the Department of Health, we would have claimed $19 million of federal match in fiscal year 10. And so $19 million of the cost increase in fiscal year 10 in the next biennium is the federal match we're not able to claim because of the $38 million unallotment in fiscal year 9. So that's a part of the $46 million Merck increase. The other part is that as part of the waiver negotiation for the Minnesota Care waiver, we agreed to caps on the amount of Merck funding that the federal government would match. In the February forecast, we are recognizing the loss of federal match on the Merck amounts over those caps. And that's the rest of the $46 million increase.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hoffman, could we reappropriate the Merck funds in 2009 and be eligible for the match?
Madam Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, yes, you could.
Any other questions so far? Okay.
Okay, going on to the other part of the medical now, there are all sorts of details on the medical assistance changes. They're in the thicker document you've got, but they sort of net out against each other, and the details are there, but I'm not going to take up your time this morning going through the details. The other part of the $77 million increase in medical assistance is there is a slightly worse economic forecast, which we are using to forecast enrollment of children and parents in medical assistance, and the cost of that small increase in enrollment. It's about a 1% increase in our enrollment forecast. It has a cost of $20 million of state funds in the next biennium. And that's the high-level story of the medical assistance forecast changes.
And down here under GRH and MSA, we've got something from the stimulus that's labeled Thrifty Food Plan Increase.
Yes. Yes, Madam
and
Chair.
That's being forecasted?
Yes.
Can you tell us about it?
The stimulus legislation... the stimulus legislation mandates a 13% increase in the Thrifty Food Plan. We have an element in GRH, the GRH base rate, which is tied to the value of the Thrifty Food Plan. And so the increase in the Thrifty Food Plan will automatically increase the GRH base rate. And that normally happens, and that's a part of the history of the GRH program, but a 13% increase is a pretty big increase, and it will add $23 per person per month to the cost of the GRH program. And so that's a cost of about $5 million a year. The piece of MSA, which is tied to the Thrifty Food Plan, is MSA Special Diets. MSA Special Diets account for about 10% of what we spend in the MSA program. And so an increase there that will average about $1.50 per MSA person per month has a cost of about $500,000 a year. And so those are the two things that are increases in our program costs that are tied to the economic stimulus legislation.
And with this Thrifty Food Plan, are we getting federal funding to help pay for it, or is it matching? We have to match it. I'm still having a little trouble understanding how our general fund spending goes up here.
The Thrifty Food Plan is the food stamp, or the new name is food support. It's the food support standard of assistance. But all of the funding for the food support program is federal money. There may be a little state non-citizen thing, but it doesn't amount to much. So essentially all the money in the food support benefits is federal money, and so the increase in that program is a federal cost. But we have these two program elements which are indexed to the value of the benefit in the Thrifty Food Plan.
In state law, we're required to raise the rates whenever that federal program increases.
What it says, in effect, in state law, is that the GRH base rate is equal to the value of the Thrifty Food Plan for one person and a piece of the SSI standard, I think. Uh-huh. And so by virtue of what of the definition in state law of the base rate, when the Thrifty Food Plan goes up, the GRH base rate goes up.
But we're not required by federal law to do that, are we?
No, we're not.
Okay. Any other questions?
The GAMC increase is more enrollment because of the economic scenario, and because the GAMC enrollment went a little bit over our forecast in the last quarter, so we had a base increase from that, and the economic scenario adds something to that. The CD fund is a decrease in the current biennium. We have been having what looks like a bottleneck effect holding down CD fund placements after a change in the certification process last summer. That has given us some more decrease in the number of placements and the payments, but it looks like that is coming to an end in the data. And so there is not much change in the forecast in the next biennium. MFIP is up $24 million in the next biennium. MFIP caseload ran over our forecast in January. We have made a change in the specification of the forecast model, which gives us a stronger effect from the rising unemployment numbers and more forecasted increase in the caseload in the MFIP program. The child care increase is based on the increase in the MFIP caseload forecast.
And Mr. Hoffman, we've noticed that there's been a surplus in the child care fund. There was a surplus at the end of last year that was projected, and there was again another surplus that we're going to see at the end of this biennium. And so I'm just wondering if the way in which we're tying child care to the MFIP growth is accurate in this particular kind of economy.
I'm not familiar with the details of how there have been issues about some federal funding carrying over. I would have to look
maybe
into
you could have
that
someone get back to
question.
Me on that. Yes, thank you.
That takes us to the end of the general fund changes. In Minnesota Care, the arrangement is the same. We have a Minnesota Care total change in forecast, $18.8 million decrease in the current biennium, $99 million decrease in the next biennium. We also get a benefit from the federal medical assistance percentage changes in the MFIP program because a large portion of the enrollment in the Minnesota Care program is funded under a Medicaid waiver. And so we show in the second line under FMAP changes the benefit of the higher FMAP rates. We also got some benefit out of the CHIP legislation. There's also a piece buried in the medical assistance forecast. The cost in the current biennium has to do with the timing of when we terminated the SCHIP waiver for Minnesota Care parents. It was part of the waiver negotiation that we had to give up the Minnesota Care waiver for Minnesota Care parents. We were basically able to make up for the fiscal benefit of that waiver by an alternative method, which is to claim SCHIP enhanced match on children over a certain income level. And doing that, even under the old law, was a better deal for the state. And the reason is that when we did the parents' waiver, we had to count, we were able to draw federal matching of 65% for the parents instead of a Medicaid match of 50%. So the benefit of the waiver was that 15-point increase in federal matching. But in order to get that benefit, we had to spend the full 65% of federal funding out of CHIP. And we were bumping against the end of our available federal funding under CHIP. The feds decided they didn't like having a waiver for parents anymore. They were never able to come out and say that to us, but they made everything as difficult as they could until the state finally agreed to give up the waiver for parents. But we were actually able to get more benefit for the state by claiming the enhanced match for children. Under the old law, children over 150 of poverty in the Minnesota Care program. And the reason that was a better deal was we could claim the enhanced match, the 15 points under the old rates. We could claim the enhanced match and only spend the enhanced portion out of the state's CHIP allocation. And so all the money we claimed was a benefit to the state instead of having to draw the whole 65%. The CHIP legislation changed the threshold over which we could claim children, changed it to 133% of poverty. So that allowed us, that is going to allow us to claim enhanced matching on more children and more expenditures. We're also able to do the same thing in medical assistance. So in medical assistance, we will be able to look at children with family income over 133% of poverty and claim the CHIP enhanced match.
And Mr. Hoffman, does this forecast change use up all of the CHIP allocation that Minnesota would get under the recently passed legislation?
Madam Chair, it does not.
So if we could get what the difference is.
Yes, we can provide that. And
Thank you. And
there is more money left in 10 and 11, but there is still money. We're still anticipating spending less than the allocation through the whole 4 years.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay.
The other changes in the Minnesota Care program, other than the federal changes, are basically the result of a lower enrollment forecast. Enrollment of children and parents in Minnesota Care actually fell by a couple thousand in the last 3 months, giving us a lower forecast. We are still forecasting increasing enrollment in the future, but we're forecasting it from a lower base. There are a couple of pictures at the end of the thicker package of our old and new forecasts of enrollment in the Minnesota Care Program. It's at the very back of the package. You have the graph on the adults without kids. It's not a very big change, but it is lower enrollment. And then page 22 shows the old and new forecast for the Minnesota Care families with kids. So those are the highlights, Madam Chair, and I'll stand
any
for
more questions for Mr. Hoffman. Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hoffman, I'm trying to track this a little bit on the in a nutshell document. It looks to me like the FMAP changes are just added in and then they're counted in the general fund other changes. They're netted out, and now it's a big just general fund, and I'm trying to figure out how that plays out in the next biennium, 12 and 13, and how it mixes with our state, you know, actual general fund stuff that we collect here from our residents, and I'm just having trouble. It looks like all of the FMAP is thrown into general fund. Is that accurate?
In most of the FMAP change affects medical assistance, and it produces a lower medical assistance forecast. And most of the programs on which we forecast expenditures are in the general fund. So when I label something general fund, it's the total of all the forecasted program. It's the total of the forecast change in all the forecasted general fund programs. And the FMAP change, and I just started out subtracting it from the total. That FMAP change is a change in the medical assistance forecast. That's where all of the general fund change comes, through the medical assistance forecast. And then what's labeled general fund other changes, that's all of the forecast change in the general fund programs, factoring out the FMAP forecast change, the FMAP effect on the forecast changes. Now, the FMAP enhanced matching ends at the end of December 2010, and so that has no effect on the 12-13 biennium. We don't have any benefit in the 12-13 biennium from the change in the federal matching rate. And if we displayed the the information on the 12-13 forecast changes is in the larger document at the end, and it's an increase very similar to the change in the 10-11 biennium, which is it's an increase of about $70 million each year, and adds up to about, oh, great. I forgot to add the tables to this document that ought to be in here.
Okay.
So are things missing I was going to refer you to. We will provide a corrected version of the document, but the forecast change in the next biennium is a total of 81 million. Has a total of 140 million. And it should have been in tables, which should have come at the end of this document. We've been very busy with the federal changes and trying to integrate this into the forecast.
I know that you have been. We also have a request for you. As long as you're repricing practically every page in the governor's budget, we have a request for repricing them also. We thought it might be easier for you to do both jobs at the same time. And it would expedite our work as well.
So reprice your proposals also, is that what the request is?
And if you could give us the pages as you get them done rather than waiting until March 22nd or whenever the governor is going to release his next budget, since it's really not, I mean, the pages we've been given already are not embargoed, so if we could get the changes as you get them done rather than waiting until then.
The changes in the governor's budget?
No,
Madam Chair?
The repricing of the pages we already have, the governor's budget.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Jane Rankin with the Department of Human Services. I think that we are still waiting for direction from MMB about what the what kind of changes to our documents that are in your books and that were released in January. I guess what the vehicle we are going to be using to get the information that you're requesting for. Certainly we will be providing spreadsheet updates to your fiscal analyst that will have the detailed information that you need to know what the repriced value of the budget pages are.
That's all we are asking for. We're not asking for new budget books. We're just asking as you reprice the pages, I don't know whether they go based on the FMAP change, if you could give us that information when you have it, as you have it.
Madam Chair, I think that the way that we are working is we're putting the pieces in the spreadsheet, and that we aren't done with working through all the pieces, but that the work product that I would be giving your fiscal analyst is an entire spreadsheet that would have all of the repricing information in it. So I don't know.
Well, I'm assuming that will be done before March 22nd. And we're asking if we can get it when you have it, rather than waiting until then.
Understood.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hoffman, too, when we get the tables in the back of the chart, I mean, maybe you could actually, in this, in a nutshell one, do extend it out to the next biennium, 12 and 13. To me, these are helpful. And to put it in context in the longer term, you know, I need to always see how it plays out. Is that something that would be?
I can do that and provide it to the committee, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Any other questions? Thank you both very much. This has been very helpful. We're going to move on then. We have a bill of Senator Ress on the agenda today. This is Senate File 137. Should be somewhat familiar. It's pretty very similar to a bill that we passed last year.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 137 is, as the chair indicated, a bill that is essentially the same as one that was actually, I think last year heard only in the full finance committee and sent to the floor with one exception in terms of the policy issue, a policy issue having to deal with the release of original birth records when a birth parent had died. The bill that passed the Senate had a provision with regard to that, but when it went to the governor, that provision was removed in the final bill. The obviously the one major change is the effective date that is pushed out until the next year, and other than that, the bill remains the same. And as far as I can tell, the fiscal note is also very similar to the one that was last year. What the bill does itself in terms of the policy is to make changes in the law to remove the distinction between pre- and post-1977 adoptions to allow adopted adults to have access to the names on their original birth certificate unless the birth parent has filed an affidavit of non-disclosure. And the effective date is pushed out over a year to allow for an education program supported by the agencies and the Department of Health to make sure that, or to ensure as far as practicable that birth parents are aware of the change that would come in the law for those persons who were adopted before 1977.
And this is a fee-supported bill. You want to tell us about the fee?
Yes, the fee for, let's see if I can remember, I think the fee for non-adopted persons is $9, and the fee for this particular service is $18 to cover the cost, any additional cost of the affidavit of non-disclosure or any other records that would accompany the birth certificate.
Are there any questions about the fiscal note? Okay. Senator Prettner-Solon?
Madam Chair, if you're ready for a motion.
Right, I think because this is a fee-supported bill, it can go out of the committee separately.
Okay, then I would move that Senate file 137 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the floor.
The full finance committee.
Full finance committee.
Any further discussion of that motion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
You're welcome.
It.
Okay. Now, the next thing we have on the agenda is a little more information about the federal stimulus, the other areas other than FMAP. And we're going to start with the Department of Health's portions, and we'll hear from Barb Julek. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Barb Julek with the Minnesota Department of Health. In your packet, there should be a handout, two-sided, six-page copy of what I'll be going through today. And this is basically a summary of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds as they relate to the department or to public health in general.
Looks like this. Everybody got one? Okay.
For the Minnesota Department of Health, there are five basic categories of funding that we are tracking. The first is $1 billion for prevention and wellness programs. There's $500 million for supplemental nutrition programs, $2 billion for environmental programs for clean water infrastructure, $2 billion for healthcare information technology, and a category I'll just say is other healthcare grants that includes primary care provider training grants. With the exception of the healthcare information grants and the provider care training grants, these federal funds are in addition to our current federal programs where we receive federal funds and will not be requiring additional state match. Also keep in mind that although we have been working hard to gather information of the funding in this act, there's many details we still do not know, and we are continuing to work on gathering information. As we receive this information, we would expect to come back and provide you additional details. Under the first category of prevention and wellness, the funding here is broken down into three programs: immunization, prevention and wellness strategies, and healthcare infection prevention strategies. At this time, while there's no specific details on how these funds will be allocated or specific uses, there has been discussions of possibilities, and I can go through some of those. Also, please keep in mind that prior to obligating any of these funds, the Federal Health and Human Services Agency must present plans to Congress before they can obligate the money. The first program I'll go through is the $300 million for immunization programs. These funds will supplement current federal funds we receive. Right now, we receive about $27 million for vaccine purchases and $4 million for operational activities under the immunization program. Since allocation methods and purposes are still under discussion at the federal level, it's not clear if these funds will be distributed via a competitive grant or via formula. The federal funds information to states has sent out estimates of state allocations that you may have seen, but we have been warned that these estimates are not valid, so we will not be using those estimates. And again, while no specific information on how the funds will be used, there has been discussions that indicate the funding could be used for vaccine purchases with some flexibility given to states for operational activities, such as local health department technology investments, specifically electronic health records, expanded clinic hours, or outreach to people for vaccination programs. Discussions also indicate that some of the money may be allocated on a competitive basis for demonstration projects for school-based vaccination programs and adult vaccination programs, and some money may also be set aside for surveillance and vaccine safety projects. It is also likely that there will be strict reporting requirements with a focus on job creation. Again, as we get specifics on these, we will continue to update you. The second category under prevention is a prevention and wellness strategy fund, $650 million for evidence-based, clinical, and community-based prevention and wellness strategies that deliver measurable health outcomes and address chronic disease. Discussion of this funding have included the potential for the Federal Health and Human Service Agency to retain up to $550 million of this for a large initiative integrated across health and human services. Again, not clear if any of this money would even come to the states at this time. It is also likely that funds out of this pot of money will not flow very quickly as to allow time to determine how these funds can be used for healthcare reform initiatives. Of the funding that may flow to states, discussion of potential uses have included focusing on diabetes and cardiovascular disease, and allocating grants based on leveling out planning and implementation grants between states. For example, if you are a state that only has a planning grant, you will likely be in line for implementation. So it's not necessarily a formula allocation, but more of leveling funding throughout the states. Similar to the immunization funding, reporting will be critical, and there will again be a focus on job creation. The final category in prevention is a $50 million grant that will go to states to address healthcare-associated infections. We do not have much information on this grant, but we are expecting some conference calls to be scheduled in the near future and would hope to provide you more information soon.
Ms. Julek, do you believe that any of these monies will need to be appropriated by the legislature, or would these monies be flowing in the form of federal grant dollars to the department without an appropriation?
Madam Chair, to the extent these funds would flow through the department, we would have to do the federal funds review, either present to the legislature or through an LIC process, depending on when applications for the federal funding go in.
Well, then we certainly will need to keep being informed, won't
Absolutely.
We?
Absolutely.
The other question that I had is, whatever of this $650 million might actually not be spent by the federal government themselves, which it's a pretty strange thing to me to allocate money based on a state share and then not send it to the state, but be that as it may, whatever is left, the question has arisen whether it could be used for our program to start this year for
CHIP.
CHIP.
I'll let Mr. Acomb answer
that. I mean, it does seem like it's sort of a nice fit, but who knows?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Craig Acomb. I'm the CFO at the Department of Health. We don't know the answer to your question, and while it does seem like a good fit, based on the language that has come down from the federal stimulus package, we don't know what the intentions of the federal government are. This money is not, as Ms. Julek said, is not being sent to CDC. Most of it's being held at the upper HHS level in the federal government, and its intention for the money is unclear at this time.
Okay, well, I know there are a lot of people hoping that that would happen, and then we could make the money that's been appropriated out of the Healthcare Access Fund, we could reappropriate that into future years, some of it or all of it maybe. Other questions on this section so far?
Scary still.
Okay, let's go on then.
Second category funding is for the Supplemental Nutrition for Women, Infants, and Children, or the WIC program. There are two allocations within this funding. The first is $400 million set up as a contingency reserve to be used by the Secretary at his discretion to support caseload increases and budget shortfalls. Currently, we receive about $131 million a year for the WIC program. And under the current WIC allocation process, funds are reallocated from underspending states to states that can spend beyond their allocations. Minnesota has been a recipient of reallocation funds in the past, and right now it's not clear how this contingency reserve will be used within that reallocation process. So we hope to learn more about that. In addition, there's $100 million set aside for implementation of new or enhancements to existing WIC management information systems. Priority of funding will be given to states that have current electronic benefit transfer and management information system projects approved and through the signing of a cooperative agreement. The next prioritized group will be new projects, and the final group will be for hardware, software, and equipment purchasing. The department is currently working on a management information system project to move a web-based application. And this will put Minnesota in good position to access these funds. We would fall under the second prioritization of funding. We plan to apply for about $3.3 million of this fund. Requests must be submitted by the end of March or early April. We would anticipate this would be a part of a federal funds review submitted to the legislature. Funds will likely not be allocated prior to May. And to the extent we do receive these funds, it would free up current WIC funding that we have been setting aside for this project.
Any questions? Okay, let's move on.
Third category funding is under the environmental grants. There's $2 billion for drinking water safety, state revolving fund. Again, this funding is in addition to current allocations that are received by the Public Facilities Authority for loans to communities for projects to help upgrade drinking water infrastructure. The department does not receive these funds, however, plays a role in reviewing and prioritizing projects and providing technical assistance. Priority for these funds must be given to projects that are under construction within the next 12 months. Less than half the money can be used for grants or principal forgiveness, and 20% of the projects must meet certain criteria such as green infrastructure or energy efficiency. The current 20% match requirement has been waived for any projects funded under the Act. And I can just my understanding is that the Public Facilities Authority does have a list of projects that has been submitted for application for these funds.
Any questions on this area? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Julek. So are you suggesting then that the PFA list that is on the books now is the list that will be utilized with these additional dollars? Or do communities that may not be on that PFA list currently, is there any room for them to apply for those funds?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, because of the 12-month shovel-ready requirement of the federal funds, the existing list has been looked to for projects that are in the queue already that have the planning, the permitting, the work already done to prepare for construction. And because there was already an existing list that met the requirements, basically all of those existing projects have been funded, or the plan is to fund all those existing projects with this money.
Thank you.
One other question about this is the matching requirement of the 20% that's being waived, does that typically come out of the state government special revenue account, or is that a general fund?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that's local match on the parts of cities that have projects moving forward.
Okay. Let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the fourth category is health information technology. Jim Golden presented information on this, including the $2 billion state infrastructure grants and the $29 billion for Medicaid and Medicare, and I would just refer you to his presentation on that category.
Right. I think the only thing that wasn't really clear, and maybe it still isn't, is how much of this might be able to be used for administration within the department.
And Madam Chair, that amount, I believe your question then to Dr. Golden had to do with the amount of the state share of the $1.6 billion that would be allocated in grants to states.
Mm-hmm.
And we still don't know the answer to that amount.
Okay. Well, we'd have to appropriate that, so you don't go to the LAC for that.
Correct.
So we hope we hear soon.
Let's do we, Madam Chair.
Let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the last category is a mixture of grants. Most of these will provide directly to providers. I will point out the first item in this category is $500 million for training for primary care providers, of which $300 million is for the National Health Service Corps recruitment and field activities. There are a number of allocations out of this $300 million fund. I will point out one, there's a $20 million for state loan repayment programs. This is the one program that does flow to states. It offers a one-to-one match program for state loan forgiveness. We currently receive $100,000 in federal funds that we match with $100,000 of state funds. And so that is one potential pot of money to flow to the states. The other allocations within this $300 million is $196 million for federal loan repayment programs, $24 million for federal scholarship programs. Both of these, again, would flow from the federal level, and both of those must be obligated by July 1st, 2010. And finally, there is $60 million to be retained by the National Health Service Corps for field operations. The balance of the $500 million is $200 million for direct grants to universities and colleges for health professional training. The balance of the summary sheet, I believe Mr. Golden had walked through, but some of the other health-related funds that we are looking at or tracking is the $1.1 billion for a Federal Coordinating Council for Cooperative Effective Research, $2 billion for the Federally Qualified Health Centers, and then funding for the Indian Health Services. And all, these last two pots of money include health technology funds that Mr. Golden had walked through as well.
Well, Ms. Julek, in regard to the matching dollars for the loan forgiveness, would we be able to use the appropriation that we have in our base to match that money?
Madam Chair, we literally just found out about this yesterday, and we're looking at that right now.
And the second part of the question then, since you're looking into it, is do we have enough to match this?
Looking at that as well.
We'll wait to hear back from you about that. Any other questions? Well, this is a little bit helpful to start at least getting an idea of what we need to know about. Let's move on then to the Department of Human Services. We're going to have Jane Rankin and Steve Nelson doing those presentations.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jane Rankin with the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Nelson with the Department of Human Services, Children and Family area, and I will start out by talking about the TANF funds that are in the stimulus bill. The TANF funds are available for increases in spending in three categories. The first category is increase in spending in your assistance caseload. The second category is in non-recurrent short-term benefits, which we know as emergency assistance and diversionary work experience program. And the third category is subsidized employment. We can receive up to 80% of our increase over a base year quarter for these particular expenditures. We've done some preliminary estimates on the forecast in terms of caseload growth. Expenditures, there may be 12 to 20 some million out there for caseload growth, stimulus funds. The range is based on whether or not we can include family stabilization services in the expenditure growth and in the caseload trigger. In non-recurrent short-term benefits category, if this category is split between DWP, which we fund, and the consolidated fund EA expenditures of the counties. In terms of DWP, that will be up in the forecast $1 million a quarter over this period. And if counties hold up on their expenditure trend, we could get a 4 times match on that additional $1 million in DWP expenditure. So we would have a way if you were to appropriate these funds to get the counties another roughly $4 million a quarter for emergency assistance expenditures. Then subsidized employment, this is something we haven't been able to track very well, and we're not exactly sure how much we could get in that particular area under the current forecast.
What is the basis for the subsidized employment increase? Is it based on your caseload, or is it based on your unemployment, or what?
Based on actual spending in subsidized employment. So you would...
Actual spending as of when?
Actual spending in a current quarter versus in a base quarter for spending.
Actual spending in a base quarter as compared to
a current quarter versus a base quarter, and the base quarter would be from 2007 or 2008. I think the only category in the budget is supported work.
Right. I don't think we were appropriating anything for supported work in those years. Were we?
Well, I think supported work was an 08 appropriation, wasn't it? We can evaluate that.
Yes, it was in 08, but we had nothing in 07.
Right.
So if we use the 07 year, then all of what we did in 08 would be counted then to be matched.
Yes, and Madam Chair, we would need to determine what part of that the stimulus language would consider subsidized employment. and we don't quite.
Well, the appropriation was made specifically for subsidized employment at the time. It was a line item in the budget.
Yes, and
appropriated to the counties for that purpose only.
And Madam Chair, I think the distinction is how much would be the actual supported employment payment to an employer on behalf of a client versus how much would be the administration around that, and we're unsure whether the administration around that would qualify.
Okay. Well, we would like to know that as soon as you figure that out. Are there any questions on this section?
And Madam Chair, if I could add, we have to request the money from the federal government. So
yes, and we have a bill to require you to request it, just in case anybody was thinking about not doing so.
And these funds are available in federal fiscal year, which starts October 08 and runs through September 30th of 2010. And then Mr. Hoffman already mentioned the increased food support benefits of 13.6%. That will go into effect in April. So that has been programmed in Maxis, and the money will be going out to the clients in April.
And that will be just added to the food portion of the TANF grant.
That's right, Madam Chair.
And there'll be an equal increase for people who are on food-only benefits?
It would be a 13.6% across the board.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on the food program? Okay.
And then moving on, the foster care and adoption assistance programs would qualify for the basic FMAP rate increase of 6.2%. A little less than half of our federal reimbursement in foster care and adoption assistance goes to the state for our adoption assistance program. So it looks like we'll be getting about $4 million in additional funds over this period. And the FMAP period runs through the end of December of 10.
Right, and does it begin last October?
That's
as
right.
The FMAP does?
That's
so
right.
We would be receiving some additional adoption assistance money for this biennium.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
$4 million savings.
And then there is a $26 million increase in the child care and development.
Just a minute. We have a question. Senator Laurie?
Yeah, Mr. Nelson, Madam Chair, thank you. Before we move on, that's $4 million for the adoption assistance. Is there additional money for the foster care as well? I mean, they should.
Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, that's correct.
It's
a county program. It might be around $5 million.
But that flows directly to the counties.
That would flow directly to the counties.
But it will be some relief for the counties that have been looking for a little relief around here.
And then moving on, Madam Chair, there is a $26 million increase in the state's child care and development block grant funding. About an eighth of that is set aside for quality improvement activities, and the rest is for increases in child care assistance. There is a supplement, not supplant, clause in the language. I guess I should mention that given the MFIP child care forecast increase in the amount of funds we are spending in child care, I think one interpretation of a maintenance of effort is that we will have made that just by the increase in the MFIP childcare, and thus.
But this would be, this would not be money that we could use to help buy out the caseload growth. It would be money we would have to, spend on top of that.
Madam Chair, I probably didn't explain that well. I would guess, and we don't have the federal regulations yet, but if the federal regulations are done similar to the last time a child care maintenance of effort was put into place, when the Personal Responsibility Act was passed, then these funds could be used to pay for that caseload growth.
They could. Okay.
And we are awaiting federal guidance. But
I understand that. We aren't going to. We understand that we're all waiting for further information. But to the best of your thinking, we might be able to use it for that.
That's right, Madam Chair.
Any other questions on the child care? All right.
And
let's move on to the child support.
On the child support side, if you remember a few years ago, the Deficit Reduction Act changed the match that, in our case, the counties could earn on child support incentives. Basically said they couldn't earn a child support match on those incentives once they were spent. A couple years ago, the state came in and we backfilled some funds for county child support programs related to that Deficit Reduction Act.
One time.
And this change is a temporary, provides a temporary ability to get that match again for a couple years. It's worth $23 million a year to the counties, but that's all in child support match. They have to spend in order to get that full amount. So this is something that doesn't necessarily help the state coffers.
No, I understand that, but we do give them money for child support activities also. Can that be used for match?
Madam Chair, not directly.
Okay. So they have to come up with their own property tax dollars to match this?
Madam Chair, they have to take the bonus that they will be receiving from the Federal Child Support Agency and take that bonus to earn the match. So it's not a property tax dollar match.
So they can use the other dollars to match these new dollars.
That's right.
Okay.
And then moving on, there's a few smaller grants that in our area that receive increases. The community services block grant was increased $1 billion nationwide, and we will receive about $12 million of that. That money is passed through to the community action programs. DHS does retain a little bit for administration, but a very small portion.
How much?
I'll have to check on that to get
right.
The exact amount. And then emergency shelter grants that flow through DHS will receive an additional $11 million. And then there's an emergency food assistance program. It's basically out of the USDA. It's a commodities program, and we get an allowance to buy surplus cheese and other products, and then the funds that you see here, the $720,000, is funds that we grant to an organization that stores and delivers those commodities to food shelves.
And under the emergency shelter grants, does it appear that any of this money would be able to be used for the programs that we funded in our budget last year with one-time money?
Madam Chair, I'd have to check on that. There's certainly a lot of similarity with those programs.
We'd like to have you get back to us on that then. Any other questions on this section? Okay, then let's move on to senior nutrition.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, Jane Rankin with DHS. Senior nutrition, what we know is that Minnesota will get $1.675 million. This is additional funding that would go through the existing nutrition programs that go through the Board on Aging. And we know that of that total, congregate meals gets $1.1 million of that amount. And then home-delivered meals gets $550,000. And these funds are available upon enactment. We think that the standard requirements of the other federal nutrition programs apply to this as well, the 15% match. So this, again, is an area where we are waiting for implementation guidance from the federal administration to find out exactly what they what else they will require from us.
Do we have a 15% match available in the Board on Aging budget in the base?
Madam Chair, my information is yes.
And do we have something to spend this on? I mean, we keep hearing from the people on the Board on Aging that the demand for meals has gone down and there is no waiting list and blah, blah, blah.
Madam Chair, Rolf Haig, Minnesota Board on Aging. The question was, do we have something to spend it on?
Yep.
I think the expectation is that with the economic downturn, there will be an increase in demand for both congregate and home-delivered meals, and I think we can anticipate a downturn in contributions that are part of the cost of the meal. So it would increase the amount of federal funding needed.
Have we seen any downturn in the contributions so far?
I really can't answer that question in the last 6 months. I can find out if we can determine that.
Okay, well. I hope we can figure out how to spend it. Are there any other questions on this item?
Madam Chair and members, I wanted to circle back a little bit more to the FMAP piece of the federal stimulus money. I don't have a handout for this part, but I just wanted to let you know that we have been informed in the last week and a half, that the allocation of increased FMAP funding for Medicaid is available to us. We are learning about the implementation requirements that CMS is expecting from us. We know that we will have to certify to certain elements that are indicated in the federal law in order to draw down the funding for Fiscal 9. We know that there is going to be new CMS is going to require us to track our funding a little differently than we have typically done, and that's because there are pretty strong new transparency and reporting requirements throughout the federal stimulus law. So we are going to need to be able to keep separate the increased FMAP funding that we receive from them from our standard base rate of 50% FMAP, which which we have a completely different and standard process to manage. We are also going to have to certify that we will not be depositing the increased funds into a reserve or rainy day account. And I understand that with the law that you passed and the governor has enacted, that we have met that particular certification requirements. There are others that have to do with the state not increasing the non-federal share of Medicaid expenditures for local entities. Again, that's an area that we will be able to certify to. But we are in the process of waiting for more guidance from CMS about a lot of this implementation information. And so I just wanted senators to understand that even though you may read in the paper that the funds are flowing to the states, that we are in the process of figuring out exactly how we need to receive them.
So probably the federal government wouldn't be real excited about the idea that we'd be using this money to do a supplemental appropriation for a sex offender program.
Madam Chair and members, the requirement in the federal law is that nothing that the state receives from the enhanced FMAP is put into a budget reserve or rainy day fund. And that's the extent of the federal language in that area. I can't speak to the sex offender program with respect to the federal law.
My understanding was it's expected to be used to cover caseload growth and or other program increases, not to be used for other correction-like programs or other public safety programs in the budget.
Madam Chair and members, I think that the overall reason for a lot of the stimulus money that's in the federal stimulus law is to assist states and local governments with budget pressures that they are facing because of the situation in our economy. And there are certainly areas in the federal stimulus law where it's clear that the federal expectation is that the states not do something or undo something. The one that I expected to hear about this morning was there's a requirement about not changing the eligibility for medical assistance to make it more restrictive than what it was last July. And that's certainly one of the areas in the federal law where we are working with CMS to understand exactly what that will mean and what their implementation direction will be to the states.
Well, we haven't done anything so far that anybody could construe as falling into that category.
That is my understanding, Madam Chair, and I know that we are getting more information from CMS to understand exactly what that will mean going forward.
And is there anything in the requirements that says that you can't increase eligibility?
Madam Chair and members, yes, there is. I need to pull out my...
That doesn't make sense.
Where's the... Madam Chair, just a minute. The consequence for making a change in your Medicaid program that goes against one of the restrictions that's in the federal law is that you lose eligibility for the enhanced FMAP, and that it would be for the enhanced FMAP for the entire period from last October through December 31st of 2010.
For that category?
I think that for expanding eligibility, it is a little bit
I think, Madam Chair, members, Shannon McMahon from the Department of Human Services Healthcare Administration, I think the open question is whether or not we'd be eligible for the enhanced FMAP if there was an expansion during the period for which we're eligible for this additional funding. And I think that's an open question that we can get back to the committee on.
Excuse me.
But it would only apply to the category that the eligibility would apply
to. Or there would be an additional.
So, for example, you know, if we got depreciation for farmers, we wouldn't be able to get the enhanced match for those families, but we'd be able to get the 50% match that we had been receiving previously.
Madam Chair, that's our understanding.
And what about activities that you might engage in order to draw down the additional CHIP money that Congress authorized? You would get the CHIP match, you wouldn't get this other match. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and members, my understanding is that we could, for some of the kids where there would be if it's possible to claim the difference between the higher FMAP, which is 61.19%, and the CHIP enhanced match of 65%, that we will be able to first draw the FMAP 61% and then go to the CHIP enhanced match and draw down that extra 4%. So we will, depending on the population, we will be able to use a blending of
even
both of those kinds.
Even if something were done that might be interpreted as increasing eligibility to get the CHIP money? I mean, I don't know how you spend it if you're not doing something to get more kids in.
Madam Chair and members, I'm not sure how, if we know yet, how we are going to be able to integrate the requirements in the new CHIP law with the federal stimulus law. And that's something that we're looking at.
Well, we hope you'll let us know as soon as you figure that out. There were some items that were passed in 08 that are pending waiver requests. Would those, because they had been passed prior to this law being passed, have the federal increase applied to them or not?
Madam Chair and members, this is one of the areas that we have been asking questions about with CMS, and we're waiting for their guidance. We're not sure.
And would they also then have the maintenance of effort requirements applied to them, to those areas that have been passed by the legislature already, but they're pending implementation?
Madam Chair, this is an area where I can't answer that question. We need guidance from CMS in order to figure that out, and we're working with them to get that answer.
Well, I guess for our planning purposes, we'll assume that we have to continue those for the maintenance of effort. Whether we get the FMAP, you'll have to let us know. I mean,
Madam Chair,
it's better to be safe than sorry, I would say, in this area.
And Madam Chair, certainly the risk is high. And we will keep you appraised when we get guidance from CMS about these kinds of questions and what it means for proposals that or elements that you enacted last year and proposals that you're working on for the future, certainly.
Questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This has to do with something that's listed as other health care grants, HHS, and it has to do with the training of primary care providers. There's $500 million there for scholarships and loans and direct grants to colleges and universities, and I'm wondering if those funds are going to flow through in the Health and Human Services area or if they are going to be working under the jurisdiction of higher education.
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, that sounds like something that the health department would be the place to ask. It's not familiar to us. It's not something that we're tracking is coming to this agency.
I think when they have HHS on here, Senator Lynch, that means that the money is flowing at the federal level through that department, but it's still going to the Department of Health.
Madam Chair, I still think it's a question that needs to be answered, and so if someone from the Department of Health would care to comment or if we could take this back to them, there's $500 million there. I think that it is prudent that we understand whether or not that's going to be something that's going to work through this division or through higher ed or a combination thereof.
Well, at this point, I would not expect it would be flowing through to higher ed. It's coming to the Department of Health. We have in our budget both loan and we have scholarships and loan forgiveness in our budget, and so I would expect it would be in our budget. But obviously, we need more details about exactly what we can do with it. Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there are, it does indicate that there's $200 million, of which some is direct grants to universities and colleges for health professional training and education. And so I think it's important to highlight that because often our higher ed institutions aren't necessarily monitoring the workings of this division, and so I think it's important that we note that for
right.
them.
I think when it says direct grants to universities and colleges, though, I think that that money is, they apply for it, and it would flow to them directly somehow, just like some of it flows to the counties directly. But, yes, I think it'd be good to get more information, and I think the health department's gone, but we'll ask them for that. Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final comment. When we received a similar sort of update from higher ed in the higher ed committee, there was no mention of any of these scholarships or grants or direct funds that might be available and accessible. So I do think that there's a need to make that connection.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much, and we'll be staying tuned for more information as you receive it.
Thank you.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Dave, I sent you an email about it.